This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
When it comes to kicking the fossil habit, the scales don't lie. In 2024, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere increased by 3.5 parts per million. That is the biggest jump since 1957, when Keeling's Mauna Loa lab started accurate records. It's the highest we've ever seen. Humans continue to hit the accelerator on global warming. This week, real scientists speak. From New Zealand and the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research, Dr. Kevin Trenberth talks ocean heating, new science, and his provocative new article. But first, we run away into the past. Oregon State University professor Peter Clark just published Global Mean Sea Level Over the Past 4.5 Million Years. Can we find a rearview mirror that helps predict our future? Here we go. It's Radio EcoShock. As the first humans evolved, big ice dominated the world. Before that, scientists found a warm period with carbon dioxide levels similar to today. In that ancient warming, sea levels were 20 to 25 meters, that's 65 to 80 feet higher than they are right now. Is our future to be found in that past? Scientists using new advances just released a study, Global Mean Sea Level Over the Past 4.5 Million Years. It also tells us about ice, oceans, and Earth in space. The lead author is Dr. Peter U. Clark, Distinguished Professor of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State University. He is also Professor of Quaternary Studies at University of Ulster. From Corvallis, Oregon, Peter Clark, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be here.
Why do we need a time map of sea level for the last few million years?
It's something that scientists and specifically paleoclimatologists and paleo-oceanographers have been working on for a long time, since the first discovery of the ice ages back in the middle of the 19th century, largely by Louis Agassiz. And so we've known that since then that glaciers and ice sheets used to be larger than they are now, and so that led to understanding or interest in understanding why that was the case, how that could have been the case, and what caused those changes in the size of glaciers and ice sheets. And of course, changes in the size of glaciers and ice sheets correspond to changes in sea level, because the water that is used to grow the ice, or as the ice melts, the water from that melting is coming from and going back to the ocean. So that corresponds to causing sea level to change. So it's a long-term question, and it's driven by curiosity, scientific curiosity, as to basically understanding how the Earth system works and how it has changed, why it's changed through Earth history.
So in this back and forth of ice growing and retreating on this planet, where would we be now without human interference?
We would be in almost exactly the same place. So human interference with the climate system is a very recent and short-lived phenomenon. It's never, of course, happened before in Earth's history to the extent that it is, and that the reason is that the major interference is from our burning of fossil fuels, causing an increase in carbon emissions and CO2 in the atmosphere. So humans, as they've been on the planet, have affected the local landscapes and the local environments, but nothing to the extent of what's happening now at the global scale. But nevertheless, it's really only in the last 150 years that influence has been significant. And that's just a very short speck of time with respect to the last 4.5 million years, for example. So the scale of which the changes that have occurred so far due to human activities are very, very small as compared to the natural changes that have occurred in the past.
But would we be heading towards a new ice age, or carrying on with the warming anyway?
So that's been a very interesting question since, the interference with the climate system by humans is first really widely appreciated and recognized, is that the coming and going of the ice ages in the past has been due to natural causes. and those are largely attributed to changes in the Earth's orbit around the sun. So those changes in the Earth's orbit around the sun and their influence on climate has been very well known through detailed calculations by astrophysicists. So we know those changes as they've occurred over the last 50 to 100 million years, and we also know how those changes will play out in the next 10 million years. So with that understanding, and without human influence on the climate system, the projections are basically that the next ice age or glaciation cycle, such as we've experienced in the past, would probably not occur for another 50,000 years or so. But due to the increase in CO2 in the atmosphere due to our activities, burning fossil fuels, and assuming that that CO2 is not removed somehow by humans and stays up in the atmosphere, which is what it does. This is the main fundamental problem with CO2, is not only is it causing global warming today, but at the same time, it will continue to cause global warming in the future because so much of it stays in the atmosphere once it's released there and only comes out of the atmosphere through natural processes very gradually. That effect, if it was not mitigated in some way, would delay the next ice age even more than the next 50,000 years, perhaps 100,000, 150,000 years or something. So in either case, either due to natural changes or with the added effect of humans that are not mitigated in some way, the next ice age will be a long ways out in the future.
Well, that's going to be a big disappointment to all the YouTube alarmists who have been saying, oh, the next ice age is going to happen next year or something. It's crazy what's out there. So meanwhile, scientists are trying to investigate a particular warm period called the mid-Pliocene warm period, or MPT. When was that, and why do we want to understand what happened then?
So the mid-Pliocene warm period, the MPWP, if that's what you're referring to, it occurred about 3 million years ago. Is that what you're referring to? Yeah. So that's actually just a fairly, it's interesting because the Pliocene itself, which is the period of time prior to the Pleistocene, which is the time when these large sea level fluctuations were occurring, and which just ended about 12,000 years ago. So the Pliocene prior to that, which started about 5 million years ago and it continued until about 2.6 million years ago, was in general a time of warmer climates, warmer temperatures than present, and higher sea levels than present. And the particular interval that scientists have focused on, this mid-Pliocene warm period, is just a short, brief period during the overall Pliocene. And they've sort of targeted that particular time as a detailed focus of their study as to why explaining that particular time. But their understanding of what caused it would apply similarly to understanding the Pliocene as a whole as to why it was warmer. And the focus has been on the Pliocene in general because it was warmer than present and was thought to be an analog for our future. But two things with that. First of all, we don't know what the CO2 was in the atmosphere during the Pliocene. We have some ideas, but the estimates range fairly broadly, so it's fairly uncertain still how much higher CO2 was that could explain the warmer temperatures and higher sea levels then. But nevertheless, let's assume it was higher. The argument would be that that would be an analog for our future at those high CO2 levels. The problem is that we're increasing CO2 by 2 to 3 parts per million in the atmosphere every year. So we've already, when they started investigating the Pliocene with this question in mind, CO2 in the atmosphere, our atmosphere, was somewhere around 350 parts per million, and they were thinking the Pliocene was maybe 400. But we've blasted through that 400 parts per million concentration in the atmosphere already, and now we're at 425 parts per million. So we're probably now well above what the Pliocene experienced. So it's not really an analog in that case because, first of all, the CO2 levels then were probably lower than they are now. And furthermore, it's very different because the CO2 levels then probably stayed at that level or similar to it, whereas what we're doing is seeing this extraordinary increase in CO2 over a very, very short period of time, which is probably pretty unique in Earth's history overall to have this amount of CO2 added to the atmosphere in such a short period of time. So at the rate we're going, and unless some serious mitigation is done, you know, we're going to be upwards of 500 to 600 to 700 parts per million or even higher by the end of the century, which would put us way past what the Pliocene level would have been. So it kind of offers an analog of an Earth that would exist under a CO2 level of 400, let's say. But we only experience that, or are going to experience that 400 level for a few years before it continues to increase well above that.
And your paper shows a pretty big transition happened around a million years ago. The cycle of ice ages and warm interglacials moved from around 41,000 years to around 100,000 years. Ice ages became more extreme with longer periods of glaciation. But why did this cycle go into longer phases?
Yeah, that's still sort of a very fundamental question. So what our paper did was we have revised that portrayal of this transition you're talking about. And in this case, this is called the mid-Pleistocene transition. So again, as you said, it occurred about a million years ago. It actually occurred between about 1.2 million and 700,000 years ago. And during that transition, the traditional view or the conventional view for basically the last 50 years since the first publication of a climate/sea level record that spanned that transition period has been that it involved not only a change in the frequency of the cycles from the shorter 41,000-year to the longer 100,000-year cycles, but also a change from smaller ice sheets to fluctuations to larger ice sheet fluctuations. So that has, again, been the long-term view until our paper has not changed the perspective that the frequency of the cycles changed from 41,000 to 100,000. But the change in the size of the fluctuations of the ice sheets did not change across the transition. They remained large since the beginning of the ice ages, about 2.6 million years ago. And from that time on, the size of the ice sheet fluctuations has been comparable to those that we last experienced 21,000 years ago at the last glacial maximum. So that's really the fundamental difference of our paper relative to the conventional thinking of this mid-Pleistocene transition. But it still leaves open the question as to why the frequency of these cycles changed from 41 to 100,000 years. And we hypothesize that that transition occurred due to a change in the frequency of fluctuations of CO2 in the atmosphere. So prior to this transition, the CO2 fluctuations were first relatively small. We're hypothesizing, we don't know for sure. But to explain the observations we have, the CO2 fluctuations were both smaller in amplitude as well as shorter in duration. That is, they were more of the line of the 41,000-year cycles. And then what happened was, though, there was still a long-term decrease in global temperature over this period of time, which we attribute to a long-term decrease in CO2, on which are superimposed these higher frequency CO2 cycles. And with that long-term cooling about a million years ago, that changed the conditions in the Southern Ocean of the world, which is the ocean that sort of circles around Antarctica. And the thing about that area of the world is that, and that Southern Ocean in particular, is it's known to be a very important reservoir of CO2. In other words, that ocean can both hold a large amount of CO2 and release a large amount of CO2, which depends on the climate. So we argue that this long-term cooling changed the conditions in the Southern Ocean, which changed the release and absorption of CO2 to occur on this longer 100,000-year timescale or frequency. And that's then what led to the change in the frequency of the sea level fluctuations and the ice sheet fluctuations.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Oregon State Professor Peter Clark. We are looking through a lens of Earth's past. Is there a reflection of the future? Your team reconstructed sea level changes over 4.5 million years. I'm thinking that would make a great sort of 3D movie if it was sped up and you could see it going up and down the mountainsides or the coastlines. It would be great to understand it in that way. What made it possible now to create such a precise long-term record?
So the difference of our reconstruction versus former reconstructions is largely, as I said, the idea that the sea level fluctuations over the last 2.5 million years have been similar in size. They've been large throughout that time. Whereas the pre-existing sort of conventional thinking has been that since these first long records were produced 50 years ago, has been that there was this change from smaller size sea level fluctuations until about a million years ago, in which point the sea level fluctuations increased in size. So in both cases, this understanding has fundamentally been derived from a record that comes from measurements of fossils that are preserved on the seafloor. And these are fossils from microorganisms. These are small little, you might call them microorganisms or planktic-sized organisms that grow little shells like clam shells, the same composition, but they're microscopic. You can really only see them under a microscope. But in those shells is recorded, the shells themselves is recorded the chemistry of the ocean at which time they formed. And the main part of the shell composition that we're interested in is the oxygen in this shell, and specifically two isotopes of oxygen, which is the oxygen 18 and oxygen 16. So the two isotopes differ in their mass or weight. And the variations of those isotopes in the shells record changes in climate and sea level together, so that when sea level is lower and climate is colder, that ratio of O18 to O16 in the shell increases, and when sea level rises and climate warms, that ratio of O18 to O16 decreases. So they've been making the measurements on these shells that have been recovered from going out to sea on ships and dropping cores down to the seafloor and bringing cores back up to the ship, taking to the lab and measuring in those shells the oxygen isotopic composition of them. So that work's been going on since the 1950s, when this whole understanding of oxygen isotopes in shells was first documented. But again, it wasn't until 1975 that the first long record of this variation in the isotopes was first published, and that was the first to span this period of time we're interested in, the last 2+ million years. And so that's where the details of the record come from in terms of the timing of these fluctuations and so forth. But the problem has been that shell is recording two things. First of all, it's recording the temperature of the water in which it's growing, and it's also recording the composition of the water in which it's growing. And those are two independent variables. So unless you know one, you don't know the other. So unless you know temperature, you don't know sea level. Unless you know sea level, you don't know temperature. And so it's always been some mix of the two that scientists have tried to understand but not been able to separate the effects of the two. So there have been efforts over the years to do that, but they've done it with an approach that basically reproduces the record you see in the shells themselves. So what we did that was different was we came up with a way to, first of all, reconstruct the ocean temperature over this period of time, and that's another story in itself. But once we know the ocean temperature, we can remove that temperature part of the isotopic composition of the shells, which leaves behind the seawater composition that's preserved in the shells. And from the seawater composition of the oxygen isotopic composition, it's from that we then computed the sea level reconstruction. And so that was what was different with our study. And we also were able to account for another important effect on that seawater chemistry of the oxygen isotopes and the changes in it, which is that early of this period of time, the Pleistocene, so let's say 2.5 million years ago, global temperature was warmer than present, and that's been known, and we published that last year in Science as well. And since then, temperature has been decreasing, global temperature has been decreasing. So the importance of that is that the ice sheets under those warmer climates will actually be different in their isotopic composition as compared to ice sheets that grow and decay under colder climates. And if you have to account for that effect on the seawater composition, I know this is complicated, but this is what we did. And so by accounting for that effect, that warmer climates will give ice sheets that have different compositions than ice sheets under colder climates, that further results in our reconstruction finding these large fluctuations in the early Pleistocene that were not reconstructed before based on methods that were used.
All right, so our listeners are picturing a graph of ups and downs of sea level over about 4 million years or more.
Yep.
What can that tell us about projected future sea level rise under global warming? Can it give us any suggestions?
Not directly, because first of all, there are two ice sheets on the Earth today. There's the Greenland ice sheet and there's the Antarctic ice sheet. And they have existed basically for this last 4 million year period. So the big sea level fluctuations we're looking at and reconstructed in the past largely are reflecting the growth of new ice sheets that don't exist today. And those ice sheets were the big ones that were over northern North America and northern Eurasia. So they would grow, and when they grew, Greenland and Antarctica would also get larger than they are now, but not by much. And then when those other large ice sheets melted away, Greenland and Antarctica would shrink, but again, not by much. So what we're looking at are really two other ice sheets that no longer exist, and their fluctuations. And so they're not directly analogous or comparable in many respects to Greenland and Antarctica. In some respects they are, but because they are different, then you can't directly make a comparison to what's happened in Greenland and Antarctica. The second thing that's different is that why we use caution in taking our results to say anything about the future, is that, as I was mentioning before, the CO2 increase that's occurring, has been occurring over the last 150 years, is extremely unusual, and it's all probably unique in Earth's history. So we've had higher CO2 fluctuations in the past, but they occurred much more gradually. So the increase in CO2 and the decrease in CO2 that would have occurred naturally in the past were changing over tens of thousands of years, unlike what's happening today, where it's changing over decades. And so that's a very different forcing of the system than what has happened naturally. And because that different forcing is occurring, then you don't necessarily think that the response of the system is necessarily going to be comparable. So you have to use caution there as well. And then thirdly, we're only looking at we're just starting to wake up these ice sheets today with respect to their responding to the warming that's been occurring. It's just a very short-term effect, and it's just the beginnings of the effect that's occurred over the last few tens of years in terms of ice sheets today. And again, which is very short compared to the tens of thousands of years of changes in ice sheets that we've seen in the past. So there are lessons we can learn from our study that relate to the future, but not directly. We can't take direct analogs of the past and apply it to the future, but we can learn lessons from the past that if we want ice sheets to exist under warmer climates, then what our study found, as was the case in that we found for our study, those ice sheets have to be really big, because when they're big, they're tall, and the tops of the ice sheets exist high up in the atmosphere where it's very cold, and thus that prevents the melting. What's happening today, and it may happen in the future, though, with Greenland and Antarctica, especially with Greenland, is the height of the ice sheet will be lowering, and so it won't be able to survive the warmer climate because it's been lowering. The Antarctic ice sheet is more complicated because not only will the height of the ice sheet be possibly lowering in the central part, but the peripheral parts of the ice sheet will be changing because of what's happening at the base of the ice sheet, and those are processes that don't apply to Greenland. So for a variety of reasons, what's happening to the ice sheets today is both in terms of the forcing that's happening and the time scale which it's all happening is very, very different than what's happened in the past. So there are some lessons, but for the most part, we can't apply our reconstruction to say much about what we might expect in the future.
Peter, do we need to reconstruct sea level rise going even further back into time, and can we?
We can. So again, this oxygen isotope record that's preserved in marine microfossils goes back over 100 million years. And from it, they've tried to separate the effects of temperature on that record compared to sea level. And so they can perhaps apply the same methodology we did now to do that. And from that, they've actually found that about 30 million years ago, prior to then, there was virtually no ice on the planet. And so that isotope record was just recording temperature. And it wasn't until about 30 million years ago that the first spurt of growth of the Antarctic ice sheet occurred. And now you've got these competing effects synchronous effects of ice sheets and temperature on the marine microfossils. So, yeah, they can continue to tease apart these two effects on that isotope ratio in the past and learn more about how Antarctica itself, which is then going to be more analogous to what's happening today, would have changed under warmer climates back then, which, again, would be more analogous to our future. So if you want to sort of draw these analogies to the future, you really need to go further back in time when CO2 levels were higher, much higher than present, and also we only had the ice sheets like today on the planet. In fact, Greenland probably didn't exist, but you still had Antarctica. That gives you a more apples-to-apples type of comparison to the future as compared to looking at the fluctuations of the Pleistocene that we examined.
So, as we wrap up, what are you working on these days?
I'm working on several different things. One is that we're continuing to use our new results to investigate how they might apply to other questions that we didn't evaluate. We're also looking at changes in the ocean heat content over the past 2 million years and what that implies about the Earth's energy balance and response to climate forcing and several other things.
From Oregon State University, we've been speaking with Dr. Peter Clark. He is lead author of the new paper, Global Mean Sea Level Over the Past 4.5 Million Years, published October 16th, 2025 in the journal Science. Find more in my show in the blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Peter, thank you for this new science and talking with us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to do so.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Dr. Kevin Trenberth is a longtime distinguished scholar at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research. Now in New Zealand, after hundreds of papers, Kevin is still publishing on things like high temperatures in the ocean in 2024 and distinctive pattern of global warming in ocean heat content. From Auckland, Kevin Trenberth, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. Happy to be here.
Before we get to crops and the existential threats to civilization, I have been saving a question for you, Kevin. Right here on Radio EcoShock, you told us about a huge loss of fish and marine mammals because of a marine heat wave in the North Pacific a few years ago. Since then, just this year, we had a months-long blob of hot water stretching right across the North Pacific, and that's only breaking down now. What do you make of this latest North Pacific ocean heat event?
Yes, so we've studied extensively the flow of heat through the climate system, and there have been substantial changes in the North Pacific in particular, also in the South Pacific where I am in New Zealand area. But the North Pacific has been quite unusual, and the weather patterns certainly seem to have changed in that region. Our analysis shows that the overall jet stream over the oceans in the Northern Hemisphere, it applies to the Pacific and the Atlantic, and the associated overall storm tracks have tended to move a little bit polewards, a little bit closer towards Alaska and in the Pacific region. And recently, there was a typhoon or an ex-typhoon that went up into Alaska and caused a tremendous amount of flooding. And so this is one of the symptoms of the change in climate, which is not fully understood.
It is interesting you raise this. You told us more than 90% of Earth's energy imbalance in the past half century has accumulated in the ocean, and the oceans are not heating up evenly, though. In your April 2025 paper, you and co-authors explore that strange fact. More heating shows up in the mid-latitudes, like the North Pacific and Atlantic. Why is that happening, and why aren't equatorial waters heating up as much as we might expect?
Yes, so I think a lot of it does indeed relate to water. You know, what happens when there is extra heat available? And so part of this is from the changes in the composition of the atmosphere, but part of it is also associated with clouds and feedbacks from clouds, which really complicate things. And so in the tropics, it's dominated by ocean regions, and the oceans are much more dynamic than they are in the middle to high latitudes. And so if you start dumping heat into the tropics, then it evokes changes like the El Nino phenomenon, and the currents begin to change and move the heat around. And in addition, they pump a lot more moisture into the atmosphere through evaporation, which produces evaporative cooling of the oceans. And then that moisture in the atmosphere fuels storms, and a lot of that gets moved into higher latitudes to the storms that are crossing the Pacific and coming into your area in northern parts of the west coast of the United States. And there's a storm that's just recently come into California, for instance.
Japan and other parts of Asia just struggled through an endless record heat this past summer. It was terrible. Do you think that is related to the North Pacific Marine heat wave?
It probably is in some way. I mean, the patterns like that are set up in the atmosphere, and so there are some regions that are more what we call anticyclonic, more settled weather, less likely for storms to occur there, and other regions are much more active, and they tend to move around from one year to the next as the ocean interacts with the atmosphere, but the patterns have been quite distinctive, haven't they, in this past summer. And it's sort of been interesting also to watch the Atlantic, where it was predicted to be a very vigorous hurricane season, and there have been a number of hurricanes, but none of them have made landfall, really, in the U.S., and so there's a distinctive pattern there, and I understand that the air is generally subsiding more, which means anticyclonic conditions, and it's less favorable for the hurricanes to form.
That is fascinating stuff. You know, we hear a lot about Arctic sea ice and melting Greenland. Meanwhile, all the extra Earth energy also arrives unseen around the South Pole. We've been covering that on Radio EcoShock, and there's changing deep currents and melting glaciers. Should we be just as concerned about ocean heating around Antarctica?
Well, the biggest warming is actually in the Southern Hemisphere. The sea temperatures have certainly been at highest levels in the North Pacific and in the North Atlantic, but the penetration of heat because of the stronger winds is greater into the Southern Hemisphere. And there's a tremendous capacity for storing the heat there, and it gradually moves things around and begins to influence Antarctic sea ice, for instance. And some of that sea ice helps to act as a buffer for the glaciers that are flowing off of Antarctica, and so it begins to affect the flow of ice and icebergs. And, you know, watching these things in action occurring on a relatively slow timetable, no doubt, but they're certainly happening.
You have a new article published October 10th in the New Zealand publication Newsroom. With your years of working on international projects like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, why do you say net zero is a pipe dream?
The headline on that article was not chosen by me. It was one of the things I mentioned in the article. But the article was intended to be somewhat provocative and was oriented towards not only climate change and the fact that the climate is changing, but also all of the other environmental factors that are in play, and in particular, the growing populations, the increasing number of refugees, if you want to call them that. There's a lot of conflicts in various parts of the globe, especially in the tropics, you know, led by what's been happening in Gaza and the Middle East, but also in the Ukraine. But, you know, there are many other places as well in Syria and in other parts of Africa that are really problematic, and people are trying to get out of there, taking unsafe boats across pieces of the ocean in order to get to other places. And now there has been a major pushback in many countries against immigration This is happening now in the U.S., and the Trump administration, in fact, has a very active program of seeking out non-legal immigrants and exporting them, in fact. But it's happened also, there's been quite large changes in places like Germany and France, and even in the U.K. This pushback is creating extra problems, and that's part of what I was addressing in this article, that with climate change, there are environmental refugees that happen because of droughts and crops not growing and fish no longer being available where they used to be. And so these kind of pressures mean that there's a real conflict that seems to be growing around the world with too many people not happy where they are and not being able to go somewhere else. And that's a key part of what my article was about.
You also talk about coming water shortages, and that is right now in Iran. They may have to move the capital out of Tehran as it runs dry. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke with former NASA scientist James Famiglietti. Their new paper shows humans and climate change are sort of teaming up to drain global groundwater, and that is going into the sea. They found groundwater transfer is currently a larger source of sea level rise than either Antarctica or Greenland melt. That surprised me. Does it surprise you?
Yeah, I don't believe that, actually. I mean, the groundwater ultimately comes from rainwater, at least in the sense that it gets renewed, and there have been major depletions of the groundwater in that area, and also in India in particular, where they've been tapping into the groundwater and using it for irrigation and various other purposes in non-sustainable ways. But global sea level is going up at around, 5 millimeters per year, and that's a huge amount of water, a relatively small region. You know, I did a study in 2011 when there were major rains in a La Nina event over Australia, but even that was able to take out about 2 or 3 millimeters on a global basis out of the global oceans. And so that's sort of the magnitude, but that's a much larger area than is currently being talked about.
And the subhead for your new article said crops now grown will no longer survive. And that's a big statement. So I did a bunch of digging, and sure enough, there are at least a dozen articles in the last 6 months, scientific, peer-reviewed, about climate limits to crops that feed billions of people. What do you think about crops when we go over 2 degrees C of global warming and beyond?
Yes, so this is indeed the issue. There's a lot of rhetoric about, increasing carbon dioxide helps plants grow. But that's only true if the other environmental conditions are okay. And if there's increasing drought, as there tends to be, the dry spells are more widespread and longer lasting. That, in turn, increases the risk of wildfire. And these are things that we see happening in the United States and in other places, in Canada and other places around the world. And so there's a real threat to the ability to grow plants in various places. And the key question is, if there's a wildfire and all of the forest or some other regime of planting is wiped out, can the crops grow back? And the evidence begins to suggest that by the time you get to the mid-2050s, when carbon dioxide has doubled in the atmosphere, then maybe there's many places around the world where things won't grow back. And, you know, if the patterns that are occurring now, subtropical deserts, can maybe spread even a little bit further towards to higher latitudes, towards the poles where many people are currently living. And some people say, well, you know, everything will just shift a little bit further to the north. But that assumes that the dirt, the quality of the soil is suitable for those plants to grow there, and that's a very dicey assumption, and in many cases it's not borne out. A lot of the ground is not suitable for agriculture, especially in hilly areas. It may be suitable perhaps for growing grass and having cows and cattle work on it or something like that, or sheep, but it does indicate that there will be changes that are sort of forced upon farmers of various kinds, and that tendency is likely to increase over time.
Yes, I can tell you as a Canadian that the bogs and the Canadian Shield, the bare rock that's in the north, is not going to grow the wheat that was growing further south, but now it's too hot. We were talking about how the water warms up unevenly, and your April 2025 paper finds it clustering around 40 degrees north, that's sort of America, the Mediterranean, North China Sea, and 40 degrees south, which is around Tasmania and your own New Zealand. Does abnormal ocean heat translate into more extreme weather on land and people in those mid-latitude belts, do we know?
Yes, so the warmer water means that when the appropriate storms come along, there is increased evaporation into the atmosphere, and in fact, we can actually measure that. And often it's what we call these atmospheric rivers. There are flows of high levels of moisture that then penetrate into places like New Zealand and recently in Tasmania, and into other places in the Northern Hemisphere, for instance, that can result in flooding, which is quite substantial. So the increased moisture gets recycled through the atmosphere and has consequences.
Do you pay much attention to what's happening with the coral?
Somewhat. I mean, there are stories that the corals are in serious trouble because of especially the Great Barrier Reef and the areas there, because of the rising temperatures in the oceans. And I think that's certainly partly true, and it's certainly true with certain species of corals. What I'm not sure about is that there seem to be quite a number of different varieties of corals that exist, and whether other corals might eventually, take their place. And I'm not sure that there's enough knowledge about those aspects of things, or whether the aquatic systems can respond in that way or not.
Well, it's interesting to note the original coral reef builders went extinct around 250 million years ago, and then after a few more millions of years, today's tropical coral moved in, but they're a completely different species. So I guess there's always hope for coral, but the 2025 Tipping Point report finds that as far as the tropical big corals of the Pacific are concerned, they've already crossed the line of no return. I'm pretty concerned about that.
Yes, so this relates to the process that we're really talking about is adaptation, whether the system can adapt and evolve fast enough to keep up with climate change, and that's really the issue. The climate change is occurring so rapidly that there's really worries, and there should be major worries that this is not the case.
So adding this all up, do you see a civilizational threat on the horizon?
Well, that's what my article was intended to be provocative about. I mean, I didn't mention AI. I thought I could have. I did think about it, but I thought, oh, that's just a bit too much for this particular article, because they always tend to have word limits on articles like this. And so I didn't actually pull that in there. But, there's enough going on, and I think far too much of what's going on is simply not sustainable. The way in which we're using so-called natural resources of various kinds, including even the developments in agriculture that have been so productive and very good, and the developments in cattle and animal use in developing meat and other food that is for humans and so on, There has been really impressive developments there, but ultimately they're probably limited. And this is one of the worries that I have, is that there are just too many people in too many places, and they create pressures, and they create, ultimately, local conflicts, and some of those conflicts grow into be bigger conflicts, and then you can have some people in authority who are not addressing those issues and, in fact, seem to take advantage of them, and I really worry about this. So in China and India and in the U.S. now, there are tendencies for strong authoritarian governments and not really planning to address these kind of issues.
I might make a small exception for China, because China has been funding a lot of climate research and reports, and they are the world's largest installer of solar panels and things like that. So I think they have climate change on their roadmap, but...
I agree with you. They've done some incredible things, but I've had quite a bit of experience and interactions with the Chinese through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and my strong impression is that the Chinese always do what they do for their own benefit. And if their own benefit happens to benefit, the rest of the world, that's more or less a coincidence, not really a core part of their planning. It's not the kind of leadership that used to exist in the United States, I don't think. But and I think India is in much the same way. India does what they can for their own population, for their own benefits, and if it happens to benefit anyone else, it's a coincidence.
Well, that describes most of the countries that I know. Unfortunately, it seems to be a human problem that we can't develop a global consciousness.
Yes, and so this also relates to the ineffectiveness of the United Nations, which is more debate chamber, but doesn't seem to be able to put things in place or carry out actions that really make advances.
From Auckland, New Zealand, we've been speaking with well-known scientist Kevin Trenberth. I use Kevin's book, The Changing Flow of Energy Through the Climate System, as my lookup for many Earth systems. You can find links to all the new science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Kevin, thank you for spending more time with our listeners.
You're most welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
As you heard in that interview with Kevin Trenberth, ice sheets versus groundwater loss and sea level rise is still debated. According to a new study published July 24th in Science Advances, groundwater loss is raising sea levels more than any ice melt at either pole. In my September 10th show, I spoke with study co-author and longtime NASA scientist Jay Famiglietti about that paper. In this week's interview, Kevin Trenberth, as an initial reaction, doubts that transfer of groundwater to the oceans contributes more to sea level rise than either Greenland or Antarctica. Trenberth says global sea level is going up around 5 millimeters per year. Estimates about that vary a bit, and some years do rise more than others. Trenberth raises his own 2011 study, which is sobering. A big rainfall event over Australia dropped so much water, it led to a rare drop in global sea levels, temporarily, despite long-term rising seas. Thousands of people fled flooding communities in Australia. Their Bureau of Meteorology reported that the second half of 2010 was the rainiest since record-keeping began in 1900. The Christmas 2010 rains flooded an area the size of Germany and France combined. 40 Queensland coal mines closed. Wheat to sugarcane crops were ruined. It was epic. Those who lived it never forgot. Combined with heavy snows in North America and rains in South America at the same time, Trenberth said this unique event in recorded history lowered sea level by about 5 millimeters. They called it a sea level bump. Water was removed from the ocean and dumped on the land that year. Nevertheless, satellite measurements say the 20-year trend is land losing water to the sea. We know more energy in the troposphere due to greenhouse gases and warmer oceans leads to more evaporation and a higher capacity of the atmosphere to hold moisture. It won't all stay up there, of course. The key is, where does the resulting rainfall come down? A simplistic answer would be, well, because ocean covers far more of Earth's surface, more rain will fall there. And unlike land, there is nowhere for it to run off. However, Earth's systems are so complex. For example, mountains may trigger rainfall, air currents may steer heavy rainstorms towards certain regions, and we know some human emissions, even plant emissions, lead to particulates in the air, the aerosols, that can stimulate rain formation. Another complication, more rain is reaching and falling on the ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica. That adds to their load and their sea level contributions, but only later, after a time delay. Even so, the Chandrapurkar and Famiglietti et al. Study is not based on models or conjecture. As far back as 2014, Famiglietti and NASA's GRACE satellites published measurements of California losing mass. The rocks don't change, so only missing water could explain that loss of gravity. The debate would be, how much water has been transferred to the ocean, and can that water be returned by superstorms or atmospheric rivers and extreme rainfall events over land, as Trenberg studied in Australia? Also, a current boom in water transfer from land to oceans may just be temporary as we pump it up. The trend may increase or decrease depending on human actions, like whether we continue to pump out groundwater on such a scale, and whether we continue to add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. It is possible Greenland ice melt or Antarctic ice melt will increase beyond this land-sea transfer to become dominant. Given past ice history and the amounts of water stored in those glaciers, that seems very likely. We are not going to get 25 meters or 82 feet of sea level rise from groundwater running or falling into the sea. That requires the ice realms to release water collected over millions of years.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
A headline cut from Kevin Trenberg's new article says, crops now grown will no longer survive. Kevin tells us he meant to be provocative. Hardly anyone is talking about this threat as we add billions more people to the planet with shrinking resources and accelerating climate change. According to a paper March 2025 led by Finnish researcher Sarah Hoikkanen, quote, potato, maize, which is corn, wheat, and soybean. These staple crops account for much of the global food supply. At 3 degrees C, large parts of their production, especially in low-latitude regions, could fail or face drastic yield reduction, though impacts are more moderate in higher latitudes. Rice, particularly threatened, with as much as 17% of production already outside suitable zones at 2 degrees C of warming. Impacts become more severe at 3 degrees C, especially in low-latitude Asia, end quote from Sarah Hoikkanen. And she and her colleagues include, under a 3 degrees C warmer world, many staple and specialty crops currently grown, especially in tropical and equatorial zones, will likely become unviable on a large scale, with particular risks to coconut, yam, cowpea, pigeon pea, rice, maize, wheat, and soybeans. Mid to high latitude regions may see less severe impacts, but widespread crop adaptation or migration will be necessary to avoid catastrophic food supply losses, end quote. And you can find a link to that in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Add in climate-induced or aggravated droughts, some lasting years, plus extreme rains as hit Australia, and generally destabilized weather, well, crops will fail in places, likely leading to mass migration by anyone able to leave, as Kevin suggests. Check out my April 2023 show, Nomad Century. That's with UK author and broadcaster Gaia Vince. You can find that at ecoshock.org. That's the real sauce on climate, crops, and mass migration.
Radio EcoShock.
As we check out, a worried hello to many listeners in California. Everybody knows insurance is going nuts there, especially after years of wildfires and other disasters. All states stopped writing new homeowner, condo, and commercial insurance policies in California since November 2022. Other companies left the state or stopped writing any property insurance there. Those who can't get insurance can apply to a government-run program called FAIR. According to blogger in the know Susan Crawford, California's FAIR plan seeks 36% rate increase as wildfire risk and insure exits surge. With $650 billion in exposure, but just $1.5 billion cash on hand, the math no longer works. Homeowners face costly coverage, rising assessments, and a volatile market going forward, ending a quote from Susan Crawford. Now, with layoffs and rising prices, more California properties may have to go without insurance, you would think, except then the banks won't provide a mortgage. What will it be this week, kids? Food or a home? When human failure meets implacable climate change, the math of life no longer works. We are at a hinge point. Massive social and economic change might lead to survival, possibly with better, more meaningful lives. That's the hope. As Bishop Tutu said, I am not an optimist. I am a prisoner of hope. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening. Tune in again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
But you say, hit the accelerator. Some gas, speed it all up, hit the accelerator.